the European experience during the decline of the Roman Empire, the cultures, the tribes that survived weren't the ones that were like, oh my gosh, Rome is cheating us, the empire is falling around us. They were like, hey, the empire is not sending anybody to come help us. We're going to have to stand up on our own 2 feet to keep what we liked about the empire, mix it with our local culture, and drive on to create something new.
You're listening to the Forum Observer Podcast.
I'm your host, Samuel Culper, formerly a soldier and a member of the U.S. intelligence community, now the executive editor of Forward Observer magazine. Heyo, and welcome to the Forward Observer podcast. I am your host, Samuel Culper, and you are listening to episode number 42, John Mosby and Forging the Hero. On this week's podcast, I'll be interviewing John Mosby. He is a former special operations soldier and a blogger, author, and tactical instructor. And John is going to come on in just a second and talk about an unconventional approach or a tribal approach to community security. I want to let everyone know that in September, I plan on being at this event called Prepper Camp. It's my first year there. However, they've had this event yearly for a few years now. I'm going to be there on the 16th, 17th, and 18th of September. It is in Saluda, North Carolina, the 16th through the 18th of September. And I hope to catch everyone there. Next week, I'm going to be talking about battle tracking. We just wrapped up last week with Operation North Coast, which was our battle tracking exercise to map the protests and riots during the GOP convention in Cleveland, Ohio. It was a little bit disappointing, frankly, because it was pretty mild. I think the weather was all right. You know, it's not like it was yesterday raining in Philadelphia, which caused the protesters to stay dry somewhere else. But, the ramp up, the lead up to the convention, everybody was saying, oh, how dangerous and how much violence there is going to take place. And the county courthouse there in Cleveland said they're going to stay open until 1 a.m. to process all these arrests. And, I think there are only about 22 or so people arrested. That's the last, as of Wednesday night, I think there was 22 people arrested. And they were planning on processing hundreds and hundreds of arrests. So next week I'll be taking everyone through the steps about how we battle track, what we need in order to do this, because in an SHTF situation, really one of the main jobs of the ACE is to remain aware of our surroundings and to figure out what's going on around us. And battle tracking is the way we take raw data and put it on a map so that we can visualize our security situation based off the information we have. So without further ado, I believe we have John Mosby on the line. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, bud.
All right, yeah, glad you could be here. We're going to talk about your new book, Forging the Hero, and it lays out this plan of, well, really it's an historical guide to the collapse of societies, and then your own take on what happens on the, you know, on the right of Bang, if you will, what we need to do in order to band together and survive these collapses. So in the very beginning of the book, you have this really great poem by Rudyard Kipling. It's called The Law of the Jungle, and it reads like this. Now this is the law of the jungle, as old and as true as the sky, and the wolf that shall keep it may prosper, but the wolf that shall break it must die. As the creeper that girdles the tree trunk, the law runneth forward and back. The strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack. Why did you include that in the very beginning of the book?
You know, really that excerpt from that poem by Kipling is the thesis of the entire book. And really, it's the thesis of my philosophy on life and the world and survival and just living a good, rewarding, virtuous life. You know, a lot of people, and I've had it come up in classes and stuff, a lot of people are like, well, that sounds really collectivist this, collectivist that, blah, blah, blah. And to a degree it is, but to a degree it's not. It's collectivist in the sense that none of us can do anything completely by ourselves. We have to have people to help us, and we have to help other people to survive and thrive. Mm-hmm. And if instead of focusing on this false paradigm of individualism, we would look around us at our families and our friends, our Keith and Ken, our tribe, our community, whatever term you want to use, and figure out where we fit into that community, we'd be a lot better off. We wouldn't care what was happening in D.C. or in New York or in Hollywood, because we'd be worried about what's happening in our communities. And that's our pack.
So the subtitle of your book is Who Does More Is Worth More. And that's in the sense of your own tribe, your own wolf pack. And I read, when you first told me the subtitle of the book, you know, the more I thought about it, it made me want to print that out on a bumper sticker and put it on the ceiling above my bed, so it's the very first thing I read every single morning. Who Does More Is Worth More. What's the significance of that subtitle?
So that's really kind of one of the underlying cultural values of Western culture. I took the line from an old book from the Middle Ages. There was a French knight named, and I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation of his name, but Geoffrey de Charny, who wrote he was commissioned by the French king to write a book of chivalry as a guide to young knights. And one of his lines in there, that was it, was who does more is worth more. Specifically, he was talking about the knight who goes to war is worth more than the knight who just fights in tournaments. The knight who fights in tournaments is worth more than the knight who sits around and gets fat and f***s slave girls. Sorry, drop the F-bomb.
It's all right.
To me, that context is, ultimately, you see a lot of these guys running around, starting militias, calling themselves colonels, blah, blah, blah. You know, we don't need to beat that dead horse, but What I look for is, what have you done to make people look up to you? You know, the guy, the prepper that's like, well, you know, everybody are just brain dead sheep and I'm not going to help them and I'm not going to tell them what I have and da 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 because OPSEC. Well, that's great. And I really do genuinely get that. However, if you are, you know, this 340-pound fat hillbilly with, you know, your tricked-out North Idaho sniper rifle, by which I mean an SKS with a scope on it, mm-hmm. and you're mad because nobody wants to listen to your, you know, your prophecies about the end of the world, maybe you need to look in the mirror and figure out, what can I do that would make people want to listen to me? What would give me legitimacy in their eyes? And ultimately the answer is, who does more is worth more. You know, if you're telling people they need to do PT, you better be doing PT. If you're telling people they need to be able to shoot a bowling pin at 550, you better be able to shoot a damn bowling pin at 550. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're telling people they need to have food storage, or they need to be raising a garden, or they need to be raising livestock, you better be doing all this stuff. Because ultimately, talk is cheap. So to me, that's what it's about. I want to be the guy in my band, in my clan, in my tribe, my community, that people know, hey, if you need X, Y, or Z done, and you either can't do it or you don't know who to find to do it for you, call John, because if he doesn't know how to do it or he can't do it, he'll find somebody that can do it for you. Because then, when they're scared and they're looking for leadership or guidance or what do? Who are they going to turn to? The guy they're used to turning to for answers. And that's not about making me, you know, the king in the sense of, you know, being on a power trip, because I'm entirely too corruptible for anybody to want me to be their king. Mm-hmm. But it's about, if I know that I have knowledge of value for the people around me who are going to help keep me alive, I want them to have that. So I want to give them as much as I need to so that they start coming to me looking for guidance. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, it sounds like during some emergency or this proverbial SHTF situation, I don't want to go to the guy who has 1,000 seeds saved up and who has done not 1 hour of gardening. I want to go to the guy who has a garden already planted annually for the past 10 years, right?
Exactly. It's really just a fancy way of saying lead by example.
Sure. Now, also in Forging the Hero, you talk about a book called The Fate of Empires, and it's a quick read. For those unfamiliar, can you describe what it's about and what you learned from it and what you added to your book from that?
Sure. So I was first introduced to The Fate of Empires by a college professor who insisted that we had to read it. This was back in the 90s, and I remember reading it and being like, wow, this is pretty deep, man. This makes sense. And then I kind of just, blew off because I had more important shit to do with my time, da-da-da-da-da. But I remember referencing it over the years. I referenced it when 9/11 happened to somebody in a phone call. The barbarians are at the gates, and da-da-da-da-da. And I came across it again a couple years ago because I mentioned it to somebody and they're like, well, what was it called? So I went looking for it and I found it. And it's really one of those things that probably ought to be required reading in high school, because it makes everything makes sense once you've read it. It's 26 pages, so it's not like you're reading Arnold Toynbee's The Story of History with its 10 or 11 or 12 volumes. It's not Oswald Spengler, The Decline of the West. It's 26 pages. You can read it on the toilet. Mm-hmm. And what he does is Sir John Bagot Glubb was one of the British officers who dealt with the turnover of Palestine to the Israelis, or to the Jews that would become the Israelis. And he looks at basically the major empires across the last 4,000 years of Western history. He doesn't touch on China. He doesn't really touch on the Indian subcontinent, which I do in the book to show the parallels. Mm. But he shows the lifespan of those empires. And they're all roughly right at 250 years. But he also, more importantly, shows the pattern of rise and fall that they go to, where it becomes obvious when an empire falls, it's not about Rome burning, because that's just one day out of 50 or 100 or 200 years of collapse. To me, The Fate of Empires is important because it's a quick, brief introduction to this is what's going on. Here's why all this stuff seems familiar, because this has all happened before. Nothing we're seeing is new. And we can use that as a model for what we actually need to be preparing for.
Which is a slow decline.
Well, yes and no. My wife and I were talking about it yesterday because of the news out of D.C. And she made a comment about, well, this kind of changes your model, doesn't it? Because this seems like it's going to accelerate things. And it's certainly a slow decline from the height of empire to people living in mud huts out in, in villages, scrabbling hand and mouth. But it's a graduated decline, for lack of a better term. There will be times of plummet, and then things will balance out because there will be some control maintained, and then things fall again. And it just keeps going downhill until something happens, like a new empire starts rising out of the darkness, if you will, the Dark Ages, and starts bringing a new empire or imperial power into, or new civilization into preeminence.
So there are different phases of empire, and that's something that you write about in the book. Can you give us an overview of the American Empire, what's happened so far, the phases we've gone through so far, and where we are now?
I don't have a copy of The Fate of Empire sitting in front of me. I think mine's in the truck because my wife's been reading it, actually. But
just in general.
Right. So you start out with your age, your pioneer age or your age of conquest, where you've got a young, aggressive, hungry culture that starts expanding outward. Towards the end of the decline, well, I'll give you a great example, actually. So in the early 600s AD, the Arabian Peninsula was a desert wasteland. You know, you had a bunch of nomadic tribes right around the desert that kind of shared some cultural values, kind of shared some language characteristics, but they weren't a people. And then about 15, 20 years later, this guy named Mo supposedly had a vision in a cave on a mountainside and came down and started preaching to people about this God that had talked to him named Allah. Muhammad died in 631 or 632, one of the two. The very next year, the Muslims burst out of the Arabian Peninsula. At that point, there were two major imperial powers in the West. You had the remnants of the Roman Empire, and you had the Persian Empire. So you had the Arabian Peninsula, and on the east side you had the Persians. On the west side you had the remnants of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. 30 years later, the Persian Empire was a memory. Hmm. 70 years later, the caliphate, this Arab Muslim Empire, stretched from what's now the Chinese border to the Atlantic Ocean. Not because Allah was blessing them or anything like that, but because you had a small, hungry, young culture that was like, hey, there's a power vacuum here, and we're going to fill it. And they did. And that's not, you know, it's not that it's good, it's not that it's bad, it's not that it's evil, it just is what it is in the larger scheme of things. You know, as bad as Islam is today, at the time, Islam really wasn't that big a deal to most of the people that lived under it, because they were like, well, it is what it is. You know, this is just life. We're either paying our tithes to the church or we're paying our tithes to, you know, the caliphate's tax man. Meanwhile, we're just doing what we got to do to survive. You know, so. And then, of course, we had the Crusades come along when the leftovers after the Roman Empire had fallen started pushing back because the caliphate had grown into decadence, and they started pushing back, and then we had what we call modern Western culture start to expand. And the same thing happens everywhere. That's the age of expansion. For us, we didn't... And I use the royal we in the sense of America, the United States. We didn't have a single imperial power we had to push out of our way. We conquered a continent. You have to go through with the beep.
That's all right.
we conquered an entire continent, a raw continent, during our age of conquest. After the age of conquest, you know, these guys that conquered in women, that conquered... they start realizing, hey, this was great, but it was a lot of work, and I'd like my kids and my grandkids to just chill out and enjoy the fruits of my labors. And then you start moving into the age of the merchants, where people are like, well, hey, you know, for this and that. And you start having commercialism take precedence. And then you move into what, you know, the age of the intellect and the age of decadence, where, well... yes, our ancestors did this, but we've moved past that. We're more advanced than them. We don't need to use violence to achieve our aims. We're going to talk about it. And then you're in your age of decline. One of the sub categories of the age of intellect and the age of decline that Gleb talks about is the age of decadence or the rise of decadence. And one of the examples that he uses is when people start looking to celebrities, athletes and artists and performers as for leadership, instead of looking to the classical leadership models like generals and explorers and statesmen. You know, to Gleb, that's when you knew you were at the end, that things were coming apart because, I mean, really, Rob Lowe for president, woohoo! Mm-hmm. I really think that's where we're at. We're on the tail end of that because we've got people that, you know, their Facebook feeds are all about what, you know, the Kardashians are doing or Jennifer Lopez is doing or Matt Damon is doing. And really, why? I mean, what qualifications do any of those people have that would make anybody with a functioning brain think they're an authority on anything except acting? You know, there is none, because we're at that point where people don't think anymore. They don't care, because as long as they've got, you know, three hots, a cot, and Oprah on the TV, they're happy. The other aspect, and this is where we start getting into the current presidential race that he talks about during this, is a search for old time religion. Not in the sense of a, you know, Baptist revival in the summertime, which we've got a bunch of going on around here right now, but in the sense of people want a return to what they're used to, you know, because the world suddenly just got really unfamiliar and things are scary because this is not the way it's supposed to work. And to me, that's what I see in the Trump campaign, you know, is there's a whole lot of people, because Trump ultimately is one of those celebrities that people are looking to. You know, yes, okay, he was a businessman and made lots of money, and da, 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 but ultimately, most people know who Donald Trump is because of The Apprentice.
Sure.
So, and he's, if you really think about it, you know, objectively, his Make America Great Again campaign is really no different than Hope and Change, because he's talking a lot of stuff, but he's not really giving you answers. Oh, we're going to build a wall, which I'll come back to. Well, how are we going to build a wall? Well, Mexico will pay for it. Why exactly do you think Mexicans are coming here? It's because their country's broke. So, but people are flocking to that because they're scared of the unfamiliar that's going on. You've got jihadism and on the rise and jihadist attacks in this country. We've got the complete and total breakdown of rule of law, as we saw. The economy in shatters, and I know the Dow is up again, but as I talk about in the book, that only matters for about 10% of Americans as far as economic recovery goes. So there's a lot of fear in the world, and that the Trump campaign is really answering that longing for a return to some good old-time religion. Of let's make America great again like it was when I was a kid. Well, okay, but you know, history kind of tells us that's not how it works. You know, so that's I would say we're definitely on the downslope.
Yeah. And speaking of the downslope, do you think we as a nation have crossed the Rubicon yet?
In a metaphorical sense, yes. In a literal sense, no. You know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is the constant cry from the right for some general or another to rise up and impeach, you know, force the president to be impeached. Mm-hmm. Something like that would be crossing the Rubicon, because literally that's what it was, is the legions weren't supposed to come south into Italy and cross the Rubicon River for fear that they would take over Rome. When Caesar did that, that's exactly what happened, is that he came in and said, hey, I'm taking over, I'm the new emperor. In a metaphorical sense, yes, because it's crossing the Rubicon colloquially has become, you know, the point of no return. We can't get things back. And that really ties into the let's build a wall thing. You know, Arnold Toynbee is one of the great historians of the last decade, and wrote a huge, like, 12-volume study of history, which follows the life cycles of empire also. And one of the things that he talks about in it that I mention in the book is when an empire is at the point where they have to build a wall to keep people out, that's the point where the empire is done. Because 50 years ago, we didn't need to build a wall, because when people came, when even mojados, you know, illegals, when they came across the river, what did they do? They went to work, they saved their money, they brought up their families, taught them, made them learn, made their kids learn English, made their kids integrate into society, and they became Americans. You know, they learned our national cultural values and became one of the innengard, the inner group of Americans. They don't do that now, because even the illiterate, non-English speaking, you know, peon from Central Mexico that comes here looking for work knows it ain't working. All he's trying to do is grab the spoils of war and send them home to his people so they get a better quality of life. So, yes, you know, yeah, we could build a wall and it would keep some people out and da da da, but it's not going to save America, because culturally we're just past, we're already across the Rubicon. In my opinion, I could be completely wrong, but I'm not.
No, I think you're on target there. So we have all these problems, America clearly in decline, and you are calling this future event, this future collapse SHTF scenario, the Renaissance, because that means that we have some opportunities to get back to the traditional cultural values that made America great. You call it the Renaissance. What kind of opportunities does the Renaissance bring us?
Well, just to clarify first, I'm not calling some future potential event the Renaissance. We're in the midst of it right now. Mm. You know, if we look back at the first Renaissance, capital R, the people at the beginning of it, they may or may not have recognized it for what it was. But it didn't really get that term till later, when people could look back with hindsight and be like, oh, look, this is where they came out of the darkness into the light. So for me, it's a matter of Renaissance literally means rebirth. And it's a matter of, we have the opportunity to be the founders, the Romulus and Remus, if you will, of the next cycle of civilization, or just the Arminius of our own tribe. It, you know, I don't have any, you know, aspirations for imperialism. I just want my people to be safe and to thrive regardless of what happens around us. So what I touched on earlier is, as one empire falls into the pit, there's already other groups elsewhere that are coming up on their own ascent to replace that group. Some of them may make it, some of them may not make it, and you know, they may make it part of the way up the ladder and then they'll just plateau out, whatever. But as it stands right now, what I see is three major rival powers to the declining American empire in the world. China is going to do what China's always done. They're going to sit over there and scoff at the, you know, the Guailos of the world, the lesser beings that are not part of the Middle Kingdom, and deal with their own thing. You have the resurgent caliphate with the jihadist movement expanding, and so far they're pretty friggin' successful at it. And then you have the nationalist Russian movement under Putin, who is striving to become the next imperial power. You know, you posted something the other day on social media through about, you know, the inevitability of conflict with Russia, and it really doesn't matter who's president or who's not. We're going to collide with Russia again, because that's just the nature of empires. There's a finite amount of resources that every empire needs to succeed, and we're going to butt heads with them over who gets control of those resources. So we can start, you know, we can start our cultural renaissance, our cultural rebirth with our small communities and everything. And we can hope for that level of success where, hey, we are going to remake America from the ground up to become once again the next great civilization in the cycle of civilizations. Or more practically, we can focus on our local communities and making sure that our cultural values, what we believe made America great in the first place, survive. So whether America breaks up into a neo-feudal Europe with lots of little duchies and vichies here and you know, a kingdom here and a dukedom there and da-da-da-da, in our communities at least, those values are going to survive. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately, that doesn't matter if we go to war with Russia or we go to war with China or the jihadists invade and instill Sharia law everywhere. If we can maintain our cultural values and our, some degree of autonomy in our local communities, then we've succeeded because our values get passed on. You know, ultimately, survival is a zero-sum game because we're all going to die. I mean, it doesn't matter how much food you stockpile, how many Band-Aids, how many rounds of ammunition. The one thing I can guarantee you, everybody listening to this is going to die eventually. Our children are going to die eventually. Our grandchildren are going to die eventually. Our obligation, in my mind, is to make sure that the values that we cherish, that we believe lead to a good life, a good quality of life, survive so our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, get to enjoy those values also. To me, the way to do that is not worrying about what's happening in the increasingly illegitimate, irrelevant District of Columbia, but it's to worry about what's going on in our local communities. Because ultimately, if someone is elected president and they completely backslide on all their campaign promises, what can I do about it? Oh, I can vote against their party in the next election. Great. And then the other party comes in and they do the same thing. But at the local level, my mayor, he has to see me every time they have a city council meeting. Because I'm going to show up. And I'm going to make sure he knows that he is accountable to the locals. You know, if my local chief of police is being a scumbag, he's accountable to local people because local people know where he lives. They can show up at his door and be like, hey, remember me? This is what you promised you were going to do and you're not doing it. You need to fix it now. And we don't have that leverage in D.C. And that's what people mean when they say all politics is local. Is it's the local thing that matters. That's all that matters. Even, you know, we can look back at the Malheur occupation and everything, and without getting too far out in the weeds on that, if those guys had actually gotten legitimate local support, the local people, the local government, the whole nine yards, that would have ended completely different. You know, now I don't know that they could have gotten local support for what they wanted to do, and that's neither here nor there, but the feds cannot succeed unless they have local support. That's why even though marijuana is still illegal under federal statute, you don't see the street side dispensaries in Oregon and California or Oregon and Colorado and Washington getting busted every day because they know they don't have the support locally to come in and actually do anything about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel that the rise in constitutional carry is a symptom of the same thing. We know the feds don't want people to have guns. But the state governments are saying, hey, you're not protecting our people. We can't protect our people. We're going to give them the power to protect themselves because that's where our obligation lies. So to me, ultimately, the opportunity that we have is to really focus on our local issues and our local communities. We need to build rapport or frith, loyalty, with the people around us. You know, if you live in Harney County, Oregon, you know, Burns, and you are upset with the way things are happening, you can get on Facebook and you can type out angry missives all you want and tell people, you know, this isn't right, this isn't right, I'm mad about this, and nobody cares. Or you can focus on the local and start raising your own food or creating economic opportunity locally to buy your own food, whichever you want to do, and building local networks so that it doesn't matter what happens elsewhere. You've got a sustainable, long-term, autonomous area that can keep those values that you share alive. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely it does. So your solution then to all these problems is, you know, that's one thing that you and Jack Donovan have talked a lot about is this concept of neo-tribalism.
Right.
Yeah, you want to talk about that a bit or maybe give some examples about how you've implemented that concept into your family and your community?
The biggest thing for us with our family and our community is just making sure people know if they need anything, I should be the first person they call. Mm-hmm. You know, even if it's something that I don't know how to do, I'll make sure that somebody that does know how to do it shows up to help them. You know, if they just need grunt labor, hey, I'm a strong dude. I can pick up heavy stuff all day. And pass it on whatever I can pass on. You know, making sure people understand that they're responsible for themselves. But if something happens to them, we're going to pick up the slack. As far as neo-tribalism goes, really, you know, the term tribe has started getting thrown around the internet a lot. And generally, people that do it demonstrate a complete and total lack of understanding of what the word means in a sociological context of a group of people who share. They may be related by blood. They may have actual shared ancestry, but it may be a mythological ancestry. So the definition is a group of people with a common shared ancestry, shared values, traditions, and customs, okay? Values, obviously, everybody knows what's our. We believe in this, this, and this. Our customs and our traditions are how we express those values publicly. So if you've got, you know, take the winter holiday as Christmas or Yule or whatever as the winter solstice, if you want to, as an example, okay? We all believe that something important happens at that time of year. Christians, it's a celebration of the birth of Christ. For non-Christians, you know, it's generally the rebirth of the year. We're coming out of the dark times into the rebirth of the light, blah, blah, blah. Ultimately, to me, it doesn't matter if somebody in my community believes that that holiday is important because it celebrates the birth of Christ, or because it's the rebirth of hope with the new year. And if you really think about it, there's a whole lot of parallel there. Mm-hmm. What matters to me is they have that value of that rebirth of hope is important to them. I know that's important to them because we share the customs and traditions of how we celebrate it. You know, yes, we have the decorations and we spend time with our family and our friends and we feast together and this and that. You know, I believe in self-reliance, you know, not at the individual level just, but at the community level. So to me, the guy who is like, oh, I believe in tribe, but every time you need help with something, he's like, oh, I got other stuff going on that day. That guy doesn't share my values because he's not willing to put aside his self-interest to help the community at large for, you know, an hour, knowing that if he helps the community today, we're going to come help him tomorrow. So it's just a matter of recognizing that those shared values are expressed through shared traditions and customs. A barn raising is a great example of that. You know, the whole community comes together and helps Bob put up his barn because next month, when Bill is building his barn, guess where Bob's going to be? He's going to be helping Bill put up his barn. And that's how that's what America was built on. You know, we have, as Americans, we, even if we're not related at all, you know, I've got neighbors that are Mexican, I've got neighbors that Mexican American or of Mexican descent, I've got neighbors that are black, I've got neighbors that are white, you know, I don't know that I have any Asian neighbors, but and we can all come together and work together because we have a shared mythological ancestry. And by that, I mean, we all look back to the founding fathers of America as these mythic ancestors of, you know, it's the Roman equivalent of Romulus and Remus. You know, I don't know if Romulus and Remus, the twins, really existed or not, but the Romans believed that they did. And that gave them a shared sense of heritage that they could cling to as they were growing. Well, we have the same thing in the founding fathers. You know, I don't know if George Washington ever actually chopped down a cherry tree and, you know, couldn't lie to his dad about it. But that myth gives us something we can relate to, even if we don't have an actual shared ancestry. We can relate to that on a mythic level and use that as a tie to bind our community together.
I think that's a message that people need to hear, and especially in the preparedness community. You know, they may intuitively get that concept, even though it doesn't have a name or as deep a philosophy as that behind it. But I'm right there with you. That's exactly what we need. You know, looking more into the, you know, unconventional warfare aspect or shaping operations or intelligence preparation of the battlefield, how do you foresee a tight-knit community being able to respond to or be able to be resilient to any kind of incursion in the future, let's say some kind of unconstitutional law being enforced? I mean, what benefits does a tight-knit community give you in terms of resiliency there?
Protection. You know, if I decide that a law that has been passed is not okay, it's not legitimate, and I choose to not obey it, I need people that, number one, I can let's use the marijuana thing as an example again, okay? Because it's still in the news and it's really convenient because it's a great model. So Oregon, I don't remember the exact date, but the day Oregon legalized marijuana, okay, the next day there were freaking storefronts popping up, okay? And they already had established customer bases. Now, we can take one of two approaches to that. We can say, oh, well, because they legalized it, all these people just out of the blue decided, hey, I'm going to try and smoke weed today. And that's probably true to some degree, but we also know that most of them were doing it before it became legal also, right?
Right.
How did those people get it beforehand when it was illegal? They went to their buddy who knew, who had a buddy that was growing pot in his backyard. So they already had these networks, these communities, these tribes put together that were based solely on trust. You know, if I lived in Oregon and decided I wanted to smoke pot before it was legal, and I didn't know where to go, I go to my cousin Bob and I'm like, "Hey Bob, you know, I need an eighth. I need some pot." And Bob's like, "Well, I don't smoke pot. Where do you want me?" I was like, "I don't know, but you you kind of run with a different crowd. You know where to go." So Bob goes to his buddy Bill, and Bill is like, "You know, I've known Bob a long time. I trust Bob. Yeah, Bob. I know where I can get some pot. How much do you want?" Well, I don't know Bill at all, and Bill doesn't know me, so Bill's not gonna trust me. But Bill trusts Bob, and Bob trusts me, so by default, there's a level of trust between Bill and I, at least for the purpose of getting what I want. So by establishing these networks that are bound by, the term is FRITH, F-R-I-T-H in modern English, and that's just, it's a sense of peace that comes from knowing that people are loyal to you because of your shared values. So it doesn't matter, you know, where I live, everybody has guns. You know, half the houses in my community have either a Gadsden flag or a Southern Cross flag flying in their front yard. You know, they're not even shy about it. They have a weekly shoot where they get together and they go out in the back pasture and shoot. If I go out on my backyard and I shoot, even though guns have been, you know, made illegal by federal fiat, I don't have to worry too much that my neighbors are going to rat me out because I know they're doing the same thing. But if I'm a jerk and don't have anything to do with any of my neighbors, that gives them an opportunity to have something to use against me to get rid of me. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I go over and I shoot with them and they're like, oh, John's a good dude, you know, he's one of us, then I don't have to worry about that anymore. Furthermore, if there's something that I need that I can't get because I'm a fugitive or because it's not available commercially anymore because it's been outlawed, if somebody in my community has it and I've built frith with them, guess what I'm going to be able to get? And even if they don't have it, they probably have a cousin or a friend or a buddy that does have it, that they have frith with, that they can get it from and then pass it on to me. And that doesn't preclude the margin of profit in there, because I'm not going to be like, well, hey, we're buddies, so you should give it to me for free, even though you paid for it. You can still work in capitalism into that. It's just the only reason that capitalist transaction takes place is because of the trust inherent in the culture. And that trust is based on shared values. And that, to me, ultimately, that's what it's about. Who does more is worth more. I know that I can trust this guy because he does more. He demonstrates our shared values every day. Because he does the right thing, even when people aren't looking.
Yeah, that's probably one of the things that made insurgent networks in Iraq and Afghanistan so resilient, is because of that literal tribalism, but also close-knit. They had frith, right? I mean, that's essentially what they had.
Yeah, there's actually, using Afghanistan, there's actually a Pashtun term for it that I talk about in the book. It's part of Pashtunwali, but I don't remember it off the top of my head. You know, as an intel guy, think about how we actually vet people in those environments. You know, yeah, you can put dude's name into a database and look for, you know, criminal records and, you know, contacts with other units and da 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 da. But ultimately, what ends up, at least in our world, you know, in the SF world, what ended up happening is some dude shows up and wants to join the fight, and we're turning to, you know, Alibaba and be like, hey, do you know this guy? Is he trustworthy? You know, and Ali is like, oh yeah, man, this is my brother's sister-in-law's cousin. He's good people. Or, you know, dude, John, this guy he's my cousin by marriage, and he's kind of a scumbag, but we let him stick around because he married into the family and we can't get rid of him. You know, and ultimately that's what we need to be looking at as we're vetting people to bring them into our network is, who do I know that knows this guy and can vouch for him? And then we slowly let them in. One of the things that I talked about in the book is the initiatory process. As Americans, we think of an initiation in the sense of college initiations into fraternities where, oh, we're going to make him do some really stupid stuff for a couple days, and then he's one of us. He's a brother to the end. That's not how the world works. You know, in tribal societies, a boy's initiation into manhood was just a test. It was like the kulex, the final exercise to make sure this kid actually understands all the stuff he's been taught his whole life growing up. Because that growing up in the tribe was the actual initiatory process. You know, SF is a great example of it. Lots of people think, you know, either Robin Sage or the Q course or selection and the Q course is the selection is the initiation process, but it's really not. It's the kind of the initiatory celebration, because all the time the guy spent in uniform up to that point, you know, learning to be a soldier, learning to be a non-commissioned officer, learning the customs, traditions, and values of the service that made him eligible to go to these courses, that's the actual initiatory process. So we can't say that, oh, well, I'm going to start a prepper group and we're going to do a weekend, you know, selection process. And if people pass it, they're in the group. And if they're not, they're not in the group. Because that's not how it works. It really needs to be a matter of, hey, you know, we met this guy the other day. He kind of seems like he might be one of us. I'm going to have him over to a barbecue. And he comes over to the barbecue and he minds his manners and he doesn't, you know, offend anybody's wife or offend anybody's in the group. He doesn't beat anybody's kids. He basically just demonstrates, you know, at least at that level, he shares values. So you're like, hey, let's have him over for a weekend camping trip and see how he does. And you just gradually keep adding opportunities to interact with this person over a span of time. And I don't know how long that span of time is, but so that you start seeing, does this guy actually have our values or is he just putting on an act? You know, one of the things I mentioned in the book is I believe an initiatory process should last at least one complete year. Because then you've seen this guy in the entire span of the social calendar. You know, oh, great, he wears multicam and has lots of cool guy patches and has an AR. Okay. He's got food storage. Okay. Does he celebrate the same holidays you do? Does he treat his wife the way you believe that a wife should be treated? Does he, you know, do X, Y, and Z the same way you do, or is he completely different? And that would actually go a long way towards, you know, winnowing out the chaff and the bad people, because they're not going to be able to keep that charade up that long unless they're really, really, really well trained, in which case, hopefully you can convert them to seeing things your way anyway. So that's, to me, that's why the tribe model is so perfect for long-term sustainability as things collapse around us. Because at the end of Rome, if you actually start reading about the European experience during the decline of the Roman Empire, the cultures, the tribes that survived weren't the ones that were like, oh my gosh, Rome is cheating us. The empire is falling around us. They were like, hey, the empire is not sending anybody to come help us. We're going to have to stand up on our own 2 feet to keep what we liked about the empire, mix it with our local culture, and drive on to create something new. And ultimately, that's where the King Arthur mythos comes from, is sometime during the first century, there was a local Romanized Briton who had, you know, as the legions were leaving Rome, he was like, yeah, okay. And it was actually later than that. It was during the Anglo-Saxon and Jute invasions of like the 4th and 5th century. But as these new outsiders were coming in, he was like, hey, we need to get our people together, you know, with these different tribes, band them together, and fight these guys. So, you know, King Arthur, and we know his name probably wasn't Arthur, went to all these other local chiefs of villages and said, hey guys, let's sit in a circle around the council fire at this round table and decide what we're going to do to fight off these invaders. Obviously, history tells us that he didn't succeed, which is why in the mythos he dies and is waiting to be brought back to save England. But so really, we need to be willing to become, you know, King Arthur or Arminius or, you know, any of these other great leaders of the past that didn't try to hold on to what was gone, but tried to take the best of what was gone and create something new and even better out of it. And that's my soapbox.
I think that's a solid plan of action. We always talk about the problems and what's going wrong and, you know, hopefully reduce some uncertainty to figure out, you know, what might happen or what's more likely or less likely to happen in the future.
ultimately it comes down to, just like a football game, who executes their game plan better?
Mm-hmm.
And if we can do these things better than our adversaries, then I think that we can win.
Absolutely. To me, it's really a matter of, it doesn't matter what's going to happen if I'm focused on doing what I need to do. You know, yes, the enemy gets a vote, but if I execute my battle drill exactly the way I'm supposed to do it, guess what? Doesn't matter what he votes, I still win. You know, well, what if he does the exact same thing in reverse? Well, if I'm doing it perfect, that means I'm doing it faster, more aggressively than him. I still win. And to me, the sensible battle drill for surviving the decline of empire is focusing on the local tribe and building a resilient community locally.
Absolutely. I agree. John, you have anything else you want to add or anything you want to talk about, advice you want to give?
Honestly, the biggest thing that I want to get across to people is quit worrying about what's going to happen in the future and look at what's happening today, right now, around you, in your community. I have had three incidents in the last month where I either went to guns on someone, I didn't shoot anybody, but I actually drew my weapon or was getting ready to draw my weapon because things were so bad in that particular situation. You know, and it wasn't a matter of, hey, I'm going to call the police because this is happening. It was a matter of, if this happens the way I think it's happening, I'm not going to have time to call the police. I need to take responsibility for this. You know, at the same time, I've had neighbors that I was driving down the road and they were having a problem, like 90-year-old lady and her cows are out in the road. Do I just mind my own business and keep driving, or do I stop and get out and help her? Hmm. Well, of course I'm going to get out and help her. I'm a decent human being, you know. But at the same time that I was doing that, I met like four other people in my community that I hadn't met yet. So not only did they see, hey, this guy's part of our community, this guy's willing to stop and help, even though he's new in the community, you know. So it's really a matter of, if people will quit worrying about what's going on elsewhere and worry about what's going on in their own community, it doesn't matter what those others in that elsewhere do if you've got your community hardened and resilient. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's my big takeaway I really want people to get from stuff is, you know, don't worry about the, you know, the potential for X, Y, or Z. Worry about what's actually happening in your community right now. Look around and see what's happening and figure out what you can do to help people get through that and get past that and overcome that.
Now, John, you have some training up. Speaking about building resiliency, do you have any open enrollment classes coming up?
I do. I've got a couple in Oregon next month. I think the deadline for those is approaching pretty quick. So people probably ought to get a hold of my wife pretty quick and get in their reservations. We may or may not have another open enrollment class coming up this year further east. I don't know. We haven't finalized that yet. But as far as it stands now, those are the last open enrollment classes for the year.
Okay. Let's work on getting you down here to Texas sometime this fall or later this year.
We will see what we can do.
All right. Very good. Well, John, thanks for joining us here on the Ford Observer podcast. I really appreciate your time. Hey, we're going to include some information, how to get in contact with you and Household 6 on our show notes page. So if you need that information, just check us out on the website or on the iTunes show notes page, and you can get that information. Also, John's most recent book, Forging the Hero, is available. I highly recommend it. It's a great book. All the things that we've been talking about are explained in much greater detail in the book. And John, thanks again for coming on.
Thanks for having me, bud. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Thanks.